Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the war comes home, the struggles of homecoming veterans and how it affects us all. Then, on the anniversary of the Charles Taylor conviction and sentencing, we revisit the good and the bad of the international criminal court system. Politicians often heap high praise onto America's veterans, but what really happens to our soldiers when they return home from war? For the tens of thousands who are injured, very little but a bureaucratic runaround, according to our next guest. Aaron Glantz is a reporter and author who has written two books. The first one, How America Lost Iraq, and The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Vets. Aaron Glantz joins us. You actually connect your new book, The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans, with your previous book because you were talking about how difficult it is to be in a war zone.
Well, I mean, it is. It doesn't matter if you're a reporter, if you are a soldier, if you are a civilian, if you are an aid worker. Being in the middle of a war is a difficult experience. And even when that experience is over, it doesn't just immediately dissipate. And so when I started writing this book, mostly as a service to the veterans who might be reading the book, who are asking themselves, where does this guy come from? Who is this guy to be telling our story? I thought it was really important that I talk about who I am and how I came to be telling this story. And the reason I started to write about veterans was because when I was an unembedded reporter in Iraq during the first 3 years of this war, and I was reporting primarily on Iraqi people and the experiences of Iraqi people under this war, and then I came home to the United States, I had a difficult homecoming. And when I wrote my first book, How America Lost Iraq, about the Iraqi people's experience of the war, when I would do speaking engagements, the people in the audience who I most connected to were always the veterans. And it didn't matter if they agreed with me or not in terms of my political analysis. You know, people who serve in the war have all kinds of ideas about the way in which the war should or should not be waged. However, when I talked to them, we were all talking about the same war. We were not talking about geopolitics and something that was on television last night, what the people in the ivory towers in Washington were thinking about. We were talking about what the streets in Najaf or Fallujah or Baghdad look like. What is the culture of the Iraqi people? What is the experience day to day of being in Iraq when there is a U.S. military occupation? And what is it like to come home from that experience and be in a situation where the top story on KFWB was about the octuplets? You have just been in a situation where you have seen other people die. Maybe some of your friends have died. If you are a soldier, maybe you killed someone. And you are grappling with the enormity of this experience. And then you turn on the radio, or you turn on the television, or you interact with the people who used to be your friends before you went over, the people who are closest to you in your family, and you can't relate to them anymore. And that's why I wrote this book. It started off as a listening expedition. I wanted the American people to understand what it's like to come home from a war and go through this process. And then the more I reported on it and the more veterans I interviewed, the more I realized that our government is actually incredibly hostile in its approach to our veterans. And it makes them battle for all the benefits that they are promised when they sign up to go kill or be killed in the war zone.
You told this in a series of stories about some of the veterans that you spoke with. There are a couple of them. Patrick the Medic, he wasn't allowed to treat Iraqi victims.
Yeah, people sign up for the military because they want to do good, regardless of how it turns out in the end. And so he signed up a long time ago, way before 9/11. Actually, he lost some members of his family in 9/11 and was mobilized to protect New York after the towers fell. And he felt really great about that. But when they mobilized him for Iraq, he had some questions, but he wanted to do his patriotic duty. He shipped out as a medic in Iraq. He was in Bakuba, which is a very dangerous area where Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the head of al-Qaeda, was eventually killed. I think that the most difficult thing for him was the sensation of feeling really patriotic, feeling like he wanted to do good, and then realizing on a day-to-day basis over there that he wasn't really wanted. And not only did he go through this experience where his job was to treat the Americans who were hurt. So if there were Iraqis who were hurt, he was forbidden most of the time from treating them. And having to see people dying and be forbidden from doing anything to save them when you have this medical training was difficult. He used to hang out. I mean, a lot of the soldiers do hang out with the kids on the street. Kids have a different interaction with soldiers than adults. And he thought that they were all his friends. But right before he shipped back to the United States, he posed for this photograph. And some of the kids in the photograph are giving him the Sieg Heil salute like he's a Nazi. Mm-hmm. And some of the other kids in the photograph are holding up an Iraqi newspaper with the Abu Ghraib prison photos. So he comes home to the United States. He looks at this picture and everything that it means, the multiple layers. And he has a wife, Melissa. Can't talk about that with Melissa. Just started drinking a lot, cutting himself off. Would go hunting with his buddies, but didn't even want to talk to them while he was hunting. Eventually, Melissa got him into the VA, pushed him to get counseling together with some other Vietnam vets who have seen it all before 30 years earlier and knew how to help the young guys. I start the book with him because his story shows how difficult this transition is even when you get the help. And many of the other people in my book do not get that help that our government promises. And, you know, some of them commit suicide. Some of them end up homeless on the street. You know, all kinds of things happen when you come home from war. You know, we have a parade, but then there's the day after the parade. And that day is the first day of the rest of your life. And all these guys are the same age as me. In fact, I'm a little bit older. I'm 31. Most of them are younger than me.
It was fascinating to read all of these accounts. There was the gentleman who had shrapnel in his brain.
Yes.
Talk about this story.
Well, this is Justin Bunce. This is a pretty common injury. You know, we have 300,000 Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans, according to the RAND Corporation, with traumatic brain injury. That's physical brain damage. That's in addition to the 300,000 veterans who are coming home with post-traumatic stress disorder or major depression, the psychological injuries. Most of the people who have these traumatic brain injuries actually have things that are a lot more subtle than what Justin Bunce had. The shrapnel took out a part of his brain that was almost like the super ego. And so here you got the 26-year-old Marine coming back making all these inappropriate comments about women because he's literally missing part of his brain. He's also missing his ability to coordinate. He's missing his short-term memory. He has to write everything down. But again, he was lucky because his father was a retired colonel who is now a lobbyist for the defense industry and has hookups on Capitol Hill to make sure that he got into one of the flagship programs that our government has in Charlottesville, Virginia. What happens if you come back from one of these head injuries and you don't have a well-connected dad?
I was thinking that a lot of these injuries maybe wouldn't even have happened had they been properly protected. Because there's a whole section in your book about the administration not being willing to fund particular types of protections.
Well, I mean, it is true that people were sent over to Iraq without adequate body armor. But it is also true that we have much, much, much better body armor this time around than we did during the Vietnam War. And we were way past Kevlar vest. I mean, people now are wearing body armor that weighs 30, 40 pounds. And actually, we have soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan with acute back injuries, shoulder injuries that just come from the tremendous strain of this body armor that they have to wear. But you go to a war, you can have all the body armor in the world, and if somebody is trying to kill you, at the end of the day, it might not do the job. And what the Bush administration failed to do was plan for that eventuality. They were extremely hostile to people who came forward during the first years of this war and said, listen, President Bush, you just started a war in Iraq. People are going to get hurt. You better hire some doctors. You better hire some nurses. You better hire some people to process disability claims. And those people who raised those concerns, they all got fired. Anthony Principi was the head of the VA under President Bush at the start of this war. He went to President Bush and said, we need more staff for a fully funded VA that can actually take care of wounded veterans. Got rid of him. This woman, Dr. Frances Murphy, gets hired by the VA to make an assessment about whether or not we are ready as a country to handle the mental wounds of the war. Writes a report in the New England Journal of Medicine saying that the mental health care available to our wounded veterans is so inaccessible as to be irrelevant, gets fired. Dr. Ira Katz, the head of the VA mental health division under President Bush, gets asked by CBS News how many veterans are committing suicide every day, and writes an email to the spokesperson of the VA, which was made public at a trial later on. The subject line is shh. S-H-H exclamation point. Don't tell CBS News that 1,000 veterans under our care attempt suicide every month. They had to pretend that nobody was going to get hurt. And they continued to pretend that for years, even while people were getting hurt in absolute terms and coming home and needing care, and they were being denied that care.
Suicide, some 5,000 a year, you say?
Yeah, 18 veterans commit suicide every day in this country, according to the VA. We have had more Vietnam veterans kill themselves than were killed in Vietnam by the enemy. We had more active duty members of the U.S. military kill themselves than died in both Iraq and Afghanistan combined. One reason in this war for the extremely high suicide rate is the fact that we redeploy people after they are already suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury. I was actually just on the phone with this woman, Kathy Fish, and her son, John, 19 years old, came back from a tour in Iraq, admitted to the military that he was having severe mental problems, was having difficulty sleeping at night, was having difficulty adjusting to being back in the States, asked for help, and the military ordered him redeployed a second time.
Oof.
He went out into the desert in New Mexico, walked off the base, went out in the middle of nowhere, and shot himself in the head. There's many stories like this in my book. Brian Rand, he had served two tours in Iraq and was being ordered back for a third and asked for help. He was already spinning out of control. His wife had to call the police a few times because he had been so abusive during flashbacks that he had while he was stateside. They ordered him redeployed anyway, and he ended up shooting himself. And all of these deaths are preventable. You know, they're not inevitable. We have thousands of suicides every year, and they're all preventable.
And other violent acts that you talked about, the gentleman who murdered the elderly lady. How prevalent is this phenomenon?
This is an extreme story that is not common, but it illustrates some themes which are more common, if that makes sense. This is one of the very first stories that I ever covered as a journalist. And, you know, when people ask me, Aaron, how did you end up going down this road of covering war for so many years? I think about Manny Babbitt. He was a Vietnam veteran. He fought at the Battle of Khe Sanh. It's one of the bloodiest battles of the Vietnam War. And while he was at Khe Sanh, some shrapnel went through his skull. It sliced him sliced his skull open. They thought he was dead. They lowered him. They put him in the hull of a helicopter with a bunch of other dead bodies. And he woke up and he came home from that and he was not the same. And he would do crazy things like walk down the street playing with tabs from soda cans for hours. He had flashbacks. He started to commit a lot of petty acts of crime that nobody could understand. And then one day in 1980, there was an elderly woman watching a Vietnam War movie in Sacramento. And there was very thick fog, and he lost it. He broke into the house, and he killed her with an iron. And I can remember when the state of California executed him in 1999. I was state capitol reporter for KPFA, and I remember the dozens and dozens of Vietnam veterans who came forward, none of whom had committed any crimes, some of whom were retired police officers who served with Manny in Vietnam, and they said, I never did anything like this. But let me tell you, sometimes I have to lock my bedroom door to make sure that I don't hurt my wife at night. And I understand this feeling. I understand where it comes from. And Manny's life and his death, it really seems like a metaphor for me. It's an extreme situation that is a metaphor for the way we treat millions and millions of American veterans. We train them to kill. We expect them to kill. They come home.
And they can't, and we don't integrate them back.
We don't even try.
Yeah.
And then when they behave badly, then we punish them and we say it was their fault all along.
Personality disorder. You talked about this classification being very meaningful in a way in which the government gets out of helping veterans.
Well, the government, the military, is strapped for soldiers. I mean, even in this lousy economy, I mean, I watched the Super Bowl. It seemed like every third ad was for the military telling me how great it was. And the reason they're spending all this money, they didn't used to have this many ads. It's because they're having difficulty getting the bodies to go fight in Iraq. In the meantime, they're having to send people for 2, 3, or 4 tours. What do they do when they got the guy who served 2 tours already and he's not fit to go back again? Well, what they should do is they should give him the care he needs and give him a medical discharge so he can get benefits and begin to get his life back together. But all too often, and for thousands and thousands of members of the armed forces, they do something entirely different. Either they try to get them on their behavior, and sometimes they take people who serve multiple tours in Iraq, and they diagnose them with personality disorder, which is like a pre-existing condition with your HMO. You know, you're not crazy because you spent time in a war zone and watched your buddies get killed. You're not sleeping with your weapon at night because you slept with your weapon at night every day in Iraq. You don't feel safe when you're sleeping in your apartment because you feel like the enemy could be right outside. You don't need counseling to deal with this. You've always been crazy. You have a personality disorder, and we're going to discharge you and not give you any benefits. It's disgusting. This classification exists because there are people with personality disorders. And if they sign up for the military, the recruiter recruits them. We need a way to discharge these people before they get deployed so they don't go to Iraq and do something really destructive. But these are the people who've already served over in Iraq and did so honorably. Then they come home and we give them this personality disorder discharge, and over 25,000 since the start of the war.
That's quite a number. You know, you actually traced back also into the Vietnam vets and the whole issue of Agent Orange.
Yes.
Talk about that. And then it was a nurse that actually started to trace this and was eventually asked to leave.
People have this idea that this battle that we make our veterans fight is new, especially since we have such fond memories of how well our country treated the World War II generation. But you can even go back to World War I, when, in the depths of the Great Depression, President Herbert Hoover decided that our World War I veterans no longer needed to get their bonus.
Hey, the revolution.
And the revolution.
The American Revolution.
The Shays Rebellion.
Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely.
These are the people who fought in the American Revolution. And then we decided after the fact that, you know what, we're not going to pay them.
Exactly.
So Agent Orange, Vietnam. People start coming home from Vietnam with chemical poisoning. They start dying of cancer in their 20s and 30s. And rather than say, oh my God, we have a problem here, the government is deny. For 26 years, the U.S. government denied anything was connected between cancer and Agent Orange until Congress intervened and said, you must presume that if somebody served in Vietnam and comes down with one of these diseases, that they probably got it in Vietnam. We have the same thing with the Gulf War syndrome. We have hundreds of thousands, about 300,000 veterans of the Gulf War that our government now estimates have Gulf War syndrome, which is caused by a composite of chemicals that our soldiers were exposed to during the Persian Gulf War in 1991. But for 17 years, the government denied that this existed. And so now here we are 17 years later, government admitted that it exists, but they're still not paying disability compensation to the people who have it. And they still have no idea to treat it because they spent 17 years denying that it even existed. And the really scary thing is when you think about our veterans returning home from Iraq and Afghanistan, we don't even know what is the Iraq and Afghanistan syndrome. What is the Agent Orange syndrome for this new generation of veterans? These things take a while to develop. They're not like the traumatic brain injury, which is a concussion to the head. I mean, our veterans are exposed to all kinds of stuff over there. But I guarantee you that as time goes on, Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans will come forward and they will be complaining about very mysterious illnesses that they got from being exposed to they don't know what. Our government can do one of two things. One is they can believe these veterans that they are coming home, that they were exposed to something over there, that they're now sick, and we can try to take care of them. Or we can do what we've done over and over again, which is tell them that they're not sick and that they should go home and take Advil.
Well, Aaron Glantz, thank you so much for being here with us today. The book, again, is called The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans, a University of California Press publication here. Thank you again, Aaron Glantz.
Oh, my pleasure.
Stay tuned.
We're all in this together. trying to help each other find the answers. What went wrong? And why aren't they dealing with it? The war for us has been more of a war after we came home.
Since I've came back home, I've had all types of sickness. The sickness started in Saudi Arabia. I bleed from my rectum and they don't know why. I have no control of my bladder anymore. For 5 years, I had stomach pains, and they said that it was all in my head. The VA hospital said it was all in my head. And our symptoms are not getting better, they're getting worse. Somebody has to do something for us. I got up and readily went to serve my country. And I was so proud to be in the military. I always tell everybody, if they call me back tomorrow, I would go. Because I loved being in the military. But I hate being a veteran.
That was from the documentary Women at War. This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. More than 250,000 Gulf War veterans suffer from Gulf War syndrome, ostensibly from exposure to toxic chemicals and nerve gas antidotes. Among Gulf War syndrome victims are women who suffer respiratory, gynecological, and neurological disorders. Women veterans have ostensibly suffered the most. Some 41% of female vets report being sexually assaulted, and their health services are often considerably less. We have with us Christy and Dennis Davis, who have finished the film Women at War that explores this particular issue. Welcome. You followed certain soldiers through their issues with the Gulf War and then after. Tell us one of the compelling stories.
The film is called Women at War, Forgotten Veterans of Desert Storm. We're following women from 1991's Gulf War. We started the film in 2002, and it was before the war in Iraq, before the war in Afghanistan. So this was the first war that women were under combat conditions. As we've made the film during 2000 to 2011, we would read the accounts of women in the current war in Iraq, which just finished, and Afghanistan, and we found that so many of the same problems, unfortunately, were the problems that the veterans faced the first Gulf War, except for Gulf War illness. When they came home, they had problems with homelessness, suicide. There are also problems with the Veterans Administration trying to get medical attention. One of the women talks about sexual assault that occurred during the first Gulf War. She tells the story of being assaulted by a bus driver. And then when she goes back to her commanding officer and tells him about it, and he says, "Were you raped?" And she said, "No, it was technically assault." He said, "Well, if you're not raped, we're not writing it up." She was assaulted once, and now she's been assaulted by her commanding officer, saying, "We're not going to bother with this." When the soldiers came back from the first Gulf War, many of them were sick, and they go to the Veterans Administration, and they say there's nothing wrong. And it was only been the course of 10, 12, 15 years that bits of information would be released and they would discover, oh yes, well, there were exposures of chemical and biological weapons because we blew up the ammunition dumps of the Iraqis during the war. The government first denied this. And to this day, the truth of what happened to the women and the men and their exposures and their illnesses, it's still a mystery. And there still has not been full disclosure by the government.
If we back up, there was one incident in the film where the sexual assaulter was perhaps Iraqi. And so the government said, yeah, if you're willing to cut off his hands.
This was a story that was told by a colonel. She's now retired. And she was very irate during her whole interview about how the women were treated under her command. And she really stood up for them. And she had a case of a woman, a nurse who was assaulted on an elevator by a Saudi soldier. And I must say that the assaults and the rapes were both Saudi, other foreign troops, and the U.S. troops. And in this particular case, she went to the commanding officer of a Saudi soldier and said, "This has got to stop. We can't have this activity towards the women." The commanding officer was playing with her and said, "Well, you tell me what you would like to do. Would you like to be demoted or punished, or what we would like is to have his hands cut off, and we would like you to do it." And so she said, If you want his hands cut off, you let me know and I'll do it. And so she stood up to this Saudi general.
Do you have a sense of the scope of the problem of, one, the Gulf War syndrome, the other illnesses, the homelessness that you mentioned, and the rape?
The rape and sexual assault, it's widespread and affects men as well as women. I know there's been a lot of information out. I know a lot of veterans groups called SWAN, which is a group called Service Women's Action Network, and I know that they lobby in Washington to try to get laws. But basically, the person who is your immediate superior can say what they want to you. They can, in case of a woman or a man, they can do what they want, and there's very little recourse that the person under them has, because then they become an outcast if they try to report their supervisor of doing this. In our film, since the women, and they're Gulf War veterans, and they all have Gulf War illness, we focused on their struggles with Gulf War illness. Gulf War illness, they call it the undiagnosed part. A lot of the people are diagnosed with fibromyalgia, MS, chronic fatigue, but I believe it's all part of the same exposures due to the Gulf War. And if they're lucky, they can get a diagnosis. One of the women in our film, Carol, she had to go to a private doctor to get a diagnosis. Once she had a diagnosis after several years, the Veterans Administration finally gave her some benefits. But it's very hard for them to get diagnosed. They're just told it's all in their head. Approximately 30% of the Gulf War veterans are disabled. But that's only the people that have gone to the VA. I would say up to close to half of them probably. And there were almost 700,000 that fought in the Gulf War. And 15% of that were women.
And let me just briefly plug Dennis Davis, who's also a musician, whose music people frequently hear on this program.
Yeah, thank you. I shot the film. We traveled all over the country, many different cities, went to conventions to sit with these veterans who were very keen to tell us their story. It was about 10 years on when we first went to the convention of National Gulf War Resources Center, and we set up a room, and women were so willing and wanting to tell their story. They lined up at the doors and they just poured their hearts out to us, because they, I guess after 10 years gone, they had enough time to process what they've gone through and were able to speak about it, because there was a lot of very heart-wrenching stories. So we felt very fortunate and honored to be there and to capture their stories.
It sounds like, though, you focused on women, but the Gulf War syndrome is something that afflicts both. Were there some that were unique to women?
Well, in the film, I go through how the Gulf War affected the women, their reproductive capacities. Many of them had hysterectomies, miscarriages, problems with severe menstrual cycles. When you have a sick veteran, the whole family is affected by the sickness of the veteran, the children, their husband. And the reason we call it Women at War is because since the women came back, they've had to battle the government to get benefits, to get treatment. Many of them were close to homelessness. One woman was told, well, we don't have anything for veterans with children, because their homeless shelters set up for alcoholics and for different people. Maybe things have changed now, but when she came back in the 90s, they weren't prepared for women. So it was very hard for her to get treatment. One of the women in the film, Carol Williams, she was the only woman at the VA when she went in for treatment. She had to be in a geriatric ward. I think even in the current wars, it's about 15% of the soldiers are women. And I think they'd be having more women's outreach coordinators, but they still outsource to other clinics the women's reproductive help and things like that. You don't have really doctors on staff at the VA that are women's doctors.
There are a couple of things that stood out for me in the film. One was the suggestion that they were classified not as women, but as honorary men. And the other was that maybe some of the pills and the shots were used almost like experimentation.
The honorary men came because they were in Saudi Arabia. The women are covered. They're not allowed to drive. And so the women soldiers weren't allowed to drive. They had to be in a cab with another man. They couldn't go out into the cities. In fact, one woman wore a costume beard because her commander wanted her to drive so she could drive through Saudi Arabia. And so they were honorary men because when they first got there, they couldn't roll up their sleeves. They had to be covered. And so when the king said, of Saudi Arabia, said they're now honorary men, then that means they could roll up their sleeves.
So they could show their forearms. Well, Christy Davis, Dennis Davis, filmmakers of Women at War, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Maria.
When we come back, we revisit the good and the bad of the international criminal court system. Next on the Scholar Circle, stay tuned.
Regret to inform you. Regret to inform you. A firstborn child, too young to understand, just asks, when's he coming home? When's daddy coming home? With child or widow weeping falls down to her knees. Please, God, say it isn't so. Say it isn't so.
This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. It has been a year since the International Criminal Court convicted, for the first time, a former head of state. Charles Taylor, former president of Liberia, was found guilty of aiding and abetting and planning some of the most heinous and brutal crimes in human history. While many said that the conviction was evidence that the system is working and that no one is above the law, critics say the process revealed a flawed system that needs an overhaul. Last year, as Charles Taylor was convicted and sentenced, we explored the pros and cons of the International Criminal Court system with three experts on international human rights law. This is a rebroadcast of that discussion. Hannah Gary is director of USC Law's International Human Rights Clinic and specializes in international human rights law, international criminal law, international humanitarian law, and international refugee law. David Kaye is executive director of UCLA Law School's International Human Rights Law Program and director of its International Justice Clinic. Mark Drumble also joins us. He is professor at Washington and Lee University School of Law and director of the university's Transnational Law Institute there. He is author of numerous books, including the award-winning Atrocity, Punishment, and International Law, and his latest, Reimagining Child Soldiering in International Law and Policy. I would like to start with this conviction of Charles Taylor, how and why it came about, and what this conviction really means for international justice. Professor David Kaye, why don't you start?
And the first thing to note is that the tribunal that, at least its trial chamber, convicted Charles Taylor, who was the president of Liberia. The tribunal was established by an agreement between the United Nations and the government of Sierra Leone. So it's a special tribunal. It's actually called the Special Court for Sierra Leone. It was specifically established in order to deal with the crimes that were committed during the civil war in Sierra Leone in the late 90s and early part of this century. And it's special in the sense that we really only have a couple of these hybrid tribunals out there. As your listeners may be familiar, there's the International Criminal Court, which is truly an international court under international law that was established by a treaty. And we have the former or the ad hoc tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda that were established by the United Nations Security Council. But this kind of special approach of a hybrid tribunal that actually brings together Sierra Leonean law and international law, brings together personnel from both Sierra Leone and from the international community, both in terms of judges, prosecutors, defense counsel, clerks, and registry officers, is really something interesting and is an important way to think about international justice really getting incorporated into a national system, particularly in a post-conflict setting like Sierra Leone, where its judiciary would probably not be capable of handling this kind of thing on its own. So just in terms of the structure, I think it's very interesting to look at. The other thing to think about in terms of this particular conviction isn't only that Charles Taylor was a head of state who's now been convicted, and he's not exactly the first, but he's really the first of the modern heads of state to go through trial and conviction. And his trial took nearly 4 years, so there may be something we want to discuss there about the length of these kinds of trials. You know, more than it being just Charles Taylor as the president, the idea that the international community could come together in this way and work with a national system in order to try somebody, and, you know, really a complicated set of facts, complicated really to address Taylor's responsibility. He was president of Liberia, and we're talking about events that occurred in Sierra Leone. You know, the fact that this trial could actually occur in itself, I think, is pretty notable and important if we're going to talk, as I think you want to, Maria, about enforcement of international human rights and international humanitarian law norms.
Hannah Gary.
It's interesting, I think, with respect to this particular trial, that it didn't happen in the region, that it was actually pulled out and that the trial took place in The Hague. So this kind of calls into question some of the goals of some of these hybrid tribunals, for example, bringing justice closer to the victims. And the reason for having the trial in The Hague was in part due to some of the controversy around the trial and security concerns with trying this former head of state. David is quite right that it is a notable conviction in that it is the first conviction we have of a former head of state, modern day anyway. And it's notable, I think, also in the respect that it did take a number of years to conclude. Also, just the arrest and apprehension of Taylor in and of itself took a lot of diplomatic maneuvering and pressure, and it was quite difficult. But I think that this trial and the conviction does send the message out there to other heads of state who may be engaging in the kinds of behavior that Taylor has been convicted for, which is aiding and abetting the crimes of various groups in Sierra Leone during the Civil War, that sends the message to other heads of state to be aware that that kind of behavior can get a conviction for that at a hybrid or international tribunal, and that also, no matter how far out you may stand trial, because there is no sort of statute of limitations with respect to these types of crimes.
Mark Drumbel?
I think we need to ask ourselves a question, which is really, in a post-conflict situation, what does justice mean? And it's easy to say that a conviction equates justice, and clearly that's the case here. He's convicted on 11 counts of crimes against humanity and war crimes. I mean, Hannah pointed out it was on an aiding and abetting theory, and that really means he played an important role in facilitating these crimes in Sierra Leone, but the prosecution wanted to convict him either as an individual, in terms of individual criminal responsibility, let's say for ordering, or as part of a broader criminal enterprise, and they were unsuccessful in that regard. But aiding and abetting was a basis for that particular set of convictions. But at the end of the day, it's important for us to take a step back and say, how are the justice interests of people on the ground in Sierra Leone necessarily advanced by this? And it's important for us not to put too much faith into a criminal conviction. But, you know, for former child soldiers in Sierra Leone, for devastated communities, for elements of society that are trying to rebuild, a criminal conviction in a distant court can be very symbolic. It can also be very expensive, but it can also, at the same time, distract from what really needs to happen on the ground in terms of reintegration, rehabilitation, community reconstruction, and so forth. So I think as people concerned about justice, we need to be circumspect about how much criminal law can advance us towards justice. And if we stop now thinking about what justice means for Sierra Leone and West Africa in general, we're selling ourselves short and we're stopping prematurely. Let me also add, Taylor has committed a lot of crimes in Liberia, and those are not part of this. The mere temporal and jurisdictional focus is on Sierra Leone. And I think that many people can look at the Taylor conviction and view it as partial justice, even in a criminal sense, because there's a lot of people who believe he was involved in much more criminality than merely his support of a particularly brutal rebel group, the RUF, in Sierra Leone.
Well, I think I see three different paths that we should go down. One is how the trial actually takes place. And David Kaye, this is one of your areas, talking about whether it should be done in the state, in the region, in an international setting, whether it should be a hybrid. So that's one important question. A second question deals with two points that Mark Drumbel, you just brought up. One is, what is justice? And how is this meaningful to victims in particular? The third item, which David Kaye, you and I have spoken about before too, deals with the issue of selective justice. Maybe we should start with selective justice first, because even within Africa, as I understand it, certain crimes against humanity, human rights violations get prosecuted and others don't. How do these get determined? David Kaye, would you like to start?
Actually, your three different paths really converge in a lot of ways. The question of selectivity, the question of how we define justice, and the question of where we imagine these kinds of trials happening, I mean, they all really come together in a lot of ways, and it's hard to talk about them separately. Since you're asking about this selectivity issue, I think there's no way around the fact that in any kind of trial, whether we're talking about international or domestic, particularly when we're talking about a post-conflict setting, that there's going to be some more or less political decision as to who gets prosecuted. You know, in the context of international trials, they simply are too expensive and have too few resources, although they look like they have enormous resources compared to some post-conflict settings, but they have too few resources to try more than the most senior individuals who are responsible for the worst kinds of crimes. That's just a capacity question. But even when you get to the domestic level, courts and other forms of justice really have a difficult time reaching too far down the chain of responsibility. And so there's always going to be the issue of selectivity, I think, even in the most sophisticated kind of system. But that's if we're going to be looking at selectivity with respect to individuals and who will be investigated and prosecuted. There's this other issue of selectivity that I think you're also alluding to, which is which states, which conflicts are subject to prosecution. And that is also another area where, particularly if we're talking about international justice or justice at the international level by international tribunals such as the ICC, that we're also going to face the same situation. In a world of limited capacity, we're going to rely on prosecutors to exercise some discretion, sometimes the Security Council, which might refer a case to the ICC, but there will always be some measure of choice and discretion there that's going to leave out some situations over others. For my part, I'm not sure we have a good metric by which we judge which are the appropriate conflicts to go to international court and tribunal and which aren't. At this point, it seems, you know, fairly political in a lot of ways, particularly if you're looking at why, you know, maybe Libya or Sudan were referred and other cases have not been referred to the ICC for investigation.
Mark Drumble, I know this is an area you've actually written about quite a bit. It sounded like you've been very critical of the system in terms of it being almost too Western. What's your response?
Well, I think that is an important point. If we think of selectivity as only who is prosecuted and what is prosecuted, we're failing to realize that there's the already tremendous level of selectivity in what we understand justice to mean, namely Western-style criminal trials. And I think if we truly think of a pluralistic understanding of justice, we need to do a lot more in terms of bringing in alternate forms of dispute resolution, truth commissions, reparations, in the context of Sierra Leone, completely irrelevant to, in many ways, the notion of individual guilt, is the structural factors that help support violence in Sierra Leone. The blood diamond trade, for example, intercessions of Western powers or failures to intercede. And these are all factors that conspire together and allow atrocity to become truly massive. And I really do think to some degree we get hung up when we say, oh, the rebel LRA are getting prosecuted in Uganda, but the Ugandan government is not, even though it committed some human rights abuses. And, oh, it's only the genocidal Hutu regime that was prosecuted in Rwanda, whereas the Paul Kagame regime today, the RPF regime, is not subject to any prosecution, even though they committed some human rights abuses as well and continue to do so. I think what that fails to really uncork is the major problem, which is international experts create criminal tribunals to deal justice. And that, to me, is a very narrow understanding of justice, and in many ways it fails to bring into play what a lot of local communities envision as a justice process. And distant incarceration and formalistic rules of procedure where a lot of evidence is out for reasons that have more to do with technical perfection and legalism than necessarily accuracy or a story that needs to be told, at the end of the day, leads in many ways to selective truths. We would be well served, and we would worry less about selectivity within the criminal law if we had much more than just criminal law standardized and mainstreamed as methods of justice. Every time there's a major conviction that comes down, conversations happen, the media reports, people pat themselves on the back when there's a conviction and say, we're an inch closer in the arc of justice. But at the end of the day, when the conviction is done, people still continue to live in post-conflict zones, and we cannot ever overestimate how their needs for justice are going to be satisfied just by this criminal conviction.
What you speak of is really almost a revamping of the entire legal thinking and culture. Hannah Gary, you've actually been in the trenches. What do you think of this?
In some respects, I do agree with Mark. There is a danger with the focus over the last 15, 20 years on international criminal law and tribunals, hybrid, or international criminal law trials at the national level as being the answer, the main way to get justice. There's a real danger in that there are other understandings of justice, and we really need to have a more nuanced, contextual approach with respect to that understanding, and also the realization that in different parts of the world, justice means different things for different communities. Also, there's the danger that we say we got that conviction and our job is done as the international community in working with a post-conflict society and not moving forward to address the root causes and the deeper problems that led to the conflict and the crimes in the first place. That being said, I do want to push back a bit in the sense that I do think that there is a universal sense among victims around the world that these trials are important, that it is important for us as the international community to say enough with impunity. And even though that justice is selective, not everyone is tried that should be tried. Moving forward, taking steps towards trying some of the most senior leaders is important, and it's imperfect. But we continue to try, and with a permanent international criminal court, with the complementarity regime, hopefully we're closing the gaps with respect to some of that selectivity, and there are more convictions being reached, hopefully in the future, and at the same time, other forms of justice being addressed, such as restorative justice, with getting victims more involved, awarding of reparations, et cetera. So I agree, but I do want to sort of hold to the idea that it's still critically important and that international criminal trials are not necessarily just a Western position on the world.
David Kay.
I think it's important to note that in post-conflict settings, I mean, this isn't the case everywhere, of course. I was with a group of Syrian human rights activists who were trying to think through what justice after Assad might look like. And they do talk about all the different levers of justice in all the different meanings that might be out there. And as you look over the last 15 to 20 years at experience in post-conflict and post-authoritarian regime societies, it's really true that you don't just have criminal justice. You do have truth commissions, you do have reparations regimes, you have vetting processes to ensure that your bureaucracies don't have holdovers with personnel who've committed crimes. There are really many, many tools out there. And I think one of the important things that I take in part from what Mark was saying was none of these should be exclusive of others, that in thinking about justice, there are a lot of purposes out there. Some of the purposes are social for the society that was the subject of the atrocities. Some of the purposes might also be for the international community and establishing norms of appropriate behavior at the most senior levels of governance. So it is important to think about all of these different mechanisms as each having some value, and I wholeheartedly agree with the idea that the focus only on criminal justice, to the extent that exists, is really problematic and doesn't get at all the different kinds of needs that exist after a conflict.
Just a reminder that this is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. Last year, as Charles Taylor was convicted and sentenced, we explored the pros and cons of the international criminal court system. This is a rebroadcast of that discussion. David Kay, one of the things you've talked about in the past with us is when you move the justice system a little bit closer to home, it actually may help develop a culture of justice and a culture of rule of law. Is that something that the West is perhaps pushing on to other places? How do we reconcile all of this with regards to rule of law, moving things into a culture that is more justice-oriented? Also, what to do in the cases where the laws are truly unjust?
There's a risk of having too high an expectation for international criminal trials, even when they're in hybrid tribunals that take place on the ground, as we see in Freetown in Sierra Leone or in Phnom Penh in Cambodia, where the Khmer Rouge Tribunal is taking place. If we ask these tribunals to really serve as some kind of demonstration effect for justice in those countries, I think we may be asking a little too much. It's important to ensure that those processes don't simply seem so opaque and so beyond the experience of one of the intended audiences, that is the national community, that they look not only as if they're genuinely foreign, but the truth that might come out, the stories that might come out of these courts and tribunals are not really understood by the people, by their audiences. So I think that's really important. At the same time, I do think that to the extent that the international community, that aid organizations can start to see that there is some value in using either the hybrid or international tribunals or simply in supporting domestic initiatives to try their own individuals at home, that should be a focus for aid agencies in the future. And again, I don't think it needs to focus solely on the criminal courts. It could be all these different mechanisms of justice that Hannah and Mark have identified. But there's definitely a need for there to be the development of rule of law in these post-conflict settings. I think people want rule of law, the people in these countries, and there needs to be support for that. We spend a lot of time and money focusing on the international tribunals when focusing on how we can help national communities take ownership of their own justice systems is probably the more important thing over the long term.
Mark Drumbel, one of your pieces talked about how these things are so complex and yet we try to apply kind of simplistic mechanisms. Can you elaborate on that as well?
Well, sure. The superimposition of criminal law on situations of atrocity with its simple categories of guilty and innocent, I think really glosses over the reality that in order for atrocity to become massive, massive numbers of people are involved with a very sublime level of degrees of responsibility, many of whom are not attaining a level of responsibility that the criminal law can grasp. I mean, the criminal law was barely able to grasp Taylor's responsibility. That's why it had to rely on this aiding and abetting theory. And even on that, the alternate judge issued some kind of a dissent saying there wasn't even enough of a basis to establish beyond a reasonable doubt Taylor's involvement in aiding and abetting this particular conduct. So imagine trying to grasp the levels of responsibility of bystanders, of people who look away when people are getting killed, of people who advance in the social structure because they're part of the right group as opposed to the wrong group. But all of those forms of human agency mesh together to create atrocity, and the criminal law doesn't have the vocabulary to deal with that, but that's a conditioned precedent to atrocity, so that's why we need much more in terms of what justice means. Also, it's important for us to emphasize these tribunals are very expensive. The Rwanda tribunal, the average cost per conviction is at least $25 million. And this is a country with a per capita GDP that's maybe a couple of $1,000 U.S. I also think what victims want, it's crucially important for us, and a lot of my own work with victims, I've heard victims express wants that international law doesn't want to hear. And those are wants that range the gamut from vengeance to forgetting. I've worked with a lot of victims in East Africa who simply view a justice process, whatever the justice process is, as investing more time, once again, in the pain of the past as opposed to moving on. And we have to be very careful in this sense with all forms of justice mechanisms. Take a restorative or reconciliatory forms of justice. One refrain that I've heard often in the Rwandese context, where to some degree there are national measures that had been put in place to try to promote community reconciliation is I've worked with victims, and the victims have said, I don't want to forgive the person who did this particular crime to me. And if a requirement of participating in a restorative process is that I forgive openly a perpetrator for the violence that he committed in exchange for him having admitted to the violence and asking for forgiveness, the victims have often reported to me that they feel they're giving away the only vestige of moral condemnation and power that they have to themselves, and that is the power to not forgive or not communicate that forgiveness. So I think we need to be careful when we think about what victims want and understand that international law, if it's truly going to be pluralistic, is going to have to deal with certain uncomfortable realities.
Hannah Gary, you get the last word.
Coming off of what Mark just said, his discussion about how, with respect to these types of crimes, take whole societies. In fact, a great example is Cambodia, the numbers of individuals that were involved. And it's true, it's very difficult to conceive and think of justice with respect to a society like that, where so many were involved, and it's a totalitarian state at the time. So there's questions about duress and inability to choose. I also completely agree with Mark with respect to really thinking carefully about what victims want. At the same time, I again come back to that perhaps with respect to some of the most senior level, the highest level, you know, heads of state like Charles Taylor, that perhaps we should make a claim as the international community that in the end, international criminal trials are required for the very highest level leaders who facilitate and make possible such mass criminality, who have the choice to do that, not only for purposes of addressing impunity, but also for purposes of the rule of law in transitional justice, transitional society situations.
Thank you, all three of you, very much for being with us. David Kay, Executive Director of UCLA Law School's International Human Rights Law Program and Director of the International Justice Clinic there. Mark Drumble, Professor at Washington Lee University School of Law and Director of the Transnational Law Institute there. Also author of the award-winning Atrocity Punishment in International Law. Hannah Gary with us, Director of USC Law's International Human Rights Clinic and specializing in international human rights law, international criminal law, and international humanitarian law. Thank you, all three of you, so very much.
Thank you, Maria.
That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chiprinankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at armudian.